Hello to the Circle of Supply Chain podcast. Today we have Johan, Johan Berdeka on the show. And Johan is someone who has been deep in supply chain worldwide in multiple continents even. So we hear something about that, Johan. And he has been really rethinking how circular supply chain should work. He has been working with lots of consumer brands. Going to be interesting to listen to that, what he thinks. So, Johan, great to have you with us today. And before we start, let's maybe get some background from your side, what your journey was and how you pulled into circular supply chains.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I got a diverse background. So I started my career in supply chain in 2009 in Taiwan. I was working between Taiwan and China for over a decade, building supply chains on the supplier side for mostly big Western brands, but also some Chinese conglomerates and Taiwanese conglomerates. It was a pivotal moment because this is when you saw the first recycled materials officially being introduced into supply chains. And I underline officially because as part of cost-cutting measures, recycling has been taking place and made its way into consumer products for quite a while before that. However, there is a limitation on the orchestration layer, which kind of limits what hard tech innovation and new supply chains can scale to. And recognizing that, I eventually co-founded Pentatonic with two Brits. We have vastly different backgrounds. Jamie had a stellar career in consumer commerce, so he was at Levi's and then got to have his own business, global business unit at Nike, tasked with innovation called Nike Lab under the heyday that Nike had in the 2010s and on. And Philip Mossop, who bootstrapped and sold two waste management and logistics related marketplaces / managed service startups. He had the vantage point on the logistics and waste management, me on the supply chain development and materials, and Jamie on the consumer commerce dynamics. And together we felt like, hey, let's build the thing that enables brands to be circular in an immediately profitable way. And then, of course,
that's quite a challenge to do. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Great to have you here. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And when you think back to your times in Asia, what did you observe, Johan, and what did you come across where you thought, yeah, the system has to change?
Yeah, so many different insights. As someone who doesn't have a manufacturing background or didn't have a manufacturing background, you can have this naive assumption that all the objects around us are constructed the way they are for a particular reason and that they're maximally optimized from a materials manufacturability, sustainability point of view. But then you very quickly discover that they're not. Everything that we touch and consume could be infinitely better, or be it on the functional side, the material side for sure, as well as the systemic, the life cycle of the product. And this agency is a really beautiful thing. This is like standing in a factory and seeing a product that's just better than what came before come off the line and be finished, or a semi-finished good or a part or a material being compounded and palletized. There's something visceral and real about that, that let's say more intellectual endeavors don't quite give you that visceral feedback. So that was exciting. So the fact that supply chains can be changed, products can be improved, and that we could all live in a world where we provide so much utility and joy to consumers, aka humans, at a previously unknown scale while operating within planetary boundaries, that's a really liberating thought. So derivative or downstream from there, we don't need to do degrowth. We just need to do up. We just need to up technology, and then we don't need to degrow, which is something I sometimes clash with some of my, let's say, climate related peers on at conferences and discussions. I'm very happy to steel man my and their argument. And lastly, I would say the manufacturing prowess that exists in China and Taiwan is incredible. And I think nowadays with TSMC being all across the news, etc., there's a bit more love and notoriety in that regard. But that is something that I realized in the early 2010s. And I felt like, how does this look as we nearshore and reshore supply chains, which is now a trend that's driven by, albeit, politically divisive forces.
Yeah, especially in these times. Yeah, and many companies talk about the circularity, but actually just a few build systems that really scale. And in your work, when you work with the big brands, where do most circular efforts hit the wall? Like, where do they have the biggest problems to scale at the end?
Yes. So there's a financial vantage point that's super important. And then there's the operational bit. So I think the big misconception is that you build a system and then implement it kind of waterfall style, to use software terminology, when the right approach is to start to build the processes that create feedback loops and network effects that then organically scale circularity in your business and across your customer base. So rather than trying to a priori think it all through, conceive of the perfect system, then do huge investments and then potentially have it, it's better to build feedback loops. So lending from a software methodology is the way to go. And it was certainly what I got wrong in my early days in circularity. I wanted to be very German about it and think it all through and conceive of the perfect bulletproof solution. But it's too multifaceted. You need too many departments in an organization to sign off, and you need lots of proof points. And you cannot prove the commercials without piloting aspects of it. So those I think are the biggest hindrances. Systemically, the biggest hindrance is that this idea of like, we need to be circular to appease environmentalists and legislation and public outrage, that's a very weak leg to stand on. I think it's not sufficient. It doesn't carry through commercial crises, and circularity should be looked at as just another efficiency measure. And efficiency tends to drive both efficiency in the sustainability realm as well as in the financial realm. So I think those are the two big ones. So like, a quick and more punchy summary would be to say, pilot fast and scale organically with network and flywheel effects and feedback loops. And also don't rely on legislation and don't look at it as a cost center to appease the environmentalists. And with those in mind, you can then find very quick success.
Perfect. And is that also the approach when you go for new materials? Because you're more on that side of the new materials discovery, bring that to market. Is that also a lot about this piloting and getting it to the companies to scale faster, or see maybe it doesn't work, so we just stop it?
Yeah, so in my past approach, life, yeah. I help brands to implement new materials quickly. So they would have a product, they would want to change the materiality so that it would be inherently more recyclable or sustainable and or made from recycled or bio-based materials. What Pentatonic does is enable this via creating circular material flows. So you start with a product, you introduce a take or buy back program that allows you to get back in touch with your end consumer, you offer them an incentive for returning the product or packaging as a brand or retailer. We have all the payment rails, the Vision AI to assess the condition of the product, offer a fair dynamically calculated price within milliseconds. And then you can upsell that consumer on the next purchase you want them to make, taking into consideration all this incredible data that you just collected. And you have the physical product, which our system automatically routes to the highest value extraction. So what do I mean by that? It's like a valorization waterfall where immediate resale ranks the highest, repair and then resale is next up, then scavenge for components, which you can reintroduce into your supply chain is next up, or recycle on the molecular/material level. And making those decisions correctly and quickly without humans in the loop makes this a very profitable endeavor. Once you have that going, you're recuperating materials, you can now afford to spend more on material procurement because you know you're getting those materials back. And then you have a superior product with better chemical, thermal, mechanical properties on the shelf that beats the competition without any additional net costs to your bottom line. And that's when you start to reach escape velocity versus your competitors that operate in a linear way, because you're now re-engaging your consumer. You got higher end consumer loyalty with your brand. You got a better end-to-end data set of how they use your product, like what condition it returned in, sole abrasion on a running shoe, depletion on a cosmetics product, etc. And you got superior materials in market, and that's where you can see that categorical shift that linearly operating brands won't be able to follow. So I think it's system first and then material introduction second, for most cases. Of course, there are use cases, for example, in architecture or e-mobility, where you can go the other way. But one of the things I learned in my first 10 years in this space is you need to have the commercial system in place first before you can confidently bet on new materials, manufacturing technologies, and product constructions.
And how long does it take to get the commercial model ready? Because that is crucial. And many say, oh, I don't have a clue, and maybe in a few years. But like, how does it usually work for you to get them on a commercial model and then go for material and the rest?
Yes. So my call to action for executives and consumer brands is, I have yet to see someone get reprimanded or fired for just going for it. It's in no one's job description to operate this broadly. But every time someone does, they get applauded for it. So it's one of those ask for forgiveness, not for permission moments in your career where you can really score. I will backpedal on this if I get someone fired by implementing a program. But it tends to be the case that as long as things deliver positive commercials without huge implementation costs, that you get a pat on the back and recognition. You know you've succeeded if your colleagues fight for the credit for a program that you spearheaded and championed. In terms of the implementation, there are some companies that already have take back, buy back, secondhand commerce programs, companies that already start to want to own their secondhand market and not hand that to third-party platforms, whether that's retailers or brands, but they just want to optimize it. That's a much quicker adoption. They're like, hey, we're operating on our own platform where we have third parties that aren't really catering to our needs. We're not extracting maximal data. There's a lot of human in the loop effort that's diminishing our margins. And so can we operate on your platform? There are a number, and I can't name names because there's a press release coming up that's embargoed before the launch date of this podcast. But you're going to see
will share it in the comments, I guess.
Yes, this is out, right? We'll make sure to do that. There are a number of beauty brands that fall into that category that had nascent programs that had aspects that performed well and aspects that were underperforming. Where we were able to take over and enhance and become the backbone, sometimes in addition to existing platforms that they use, and sometimes replacing existing platforms that they use, and sometimes being the first platform that they use. So that's a quick sale, if you will. We're like, hey, you have something. We spent years and, you know, raised eight figures to build something much, much better with like world-leading AI ML capabilities, partnering with NVIDIA and MasterCard and ServiceNow, like, this is the product of our collective obsession here at Pentatonic. Want to use it? Great. And then there are companies who are like, hey, we're thinking about this in the abstract, but we need a bit of time. And we do forward deploy engineers. We do have something like akin to a consulting function, very minimal, working oftentimes in collaboration with consultancies to create the decision-making materials that are necessary to implement these things. And I think a few learnings are, The top learning is pilot quickly and cheaply, because you always learn something, and it's always, you learn two things: how you can do better, but usually you'll also find that it's working pretty well right off the bat without optimization, and that really helps to drive a commitment across especially larger organizations. So limited quick pilots for the win. But we also have customers that are more conservative, that are using Pentatonic, that don't publicly talk about it, that took, and the longest one was 18 months of very intense analysis before adopting our platform.
So you can compare it more like the startup world, where they also have to do on a POC quickly, see the results, move forward, and these rhythms, they just to get better with their products and then scale, right?
Totally. It's tech, just because tech will reach into the physical world more and more. So we will see more. I mean, we have hardware that, like, you know, return kiosks that go into stores and retail environments. We're going to launch a new generation of those very, very soon, within less than a month, which I'm super excited about. And so there's a even though it has a hardware aspect, it's best implemented like software. And my prediction for hard tech is that it will learn a little bit from software. Obviously, it will never be software, but in terms of the learnings that you need to extract as AI meets the physical world, that playbook tends to work better.
You spoke about different adoption rates of different companies, Johan, and how do you see the different adoption rates in industry and verticals? You have been working in so many different verticals. Do you see systematic constraints in one or the other? And where do you see how far they are, and where are still the major hurdles?
Okay. Contrarian, I'm going to be slightly hyperbolic. I think a lot of mistakes that were made by startups in circularity is to aim for fashion first. It's a huge market. It's a hugely polluting market. The 200 million or so tons of fibers that we make per annum are taking a hefty toll at the extraction and disposal phase. But that doesn't mean that it's easy to conquer and easy to go to market in. And you saw the early wins go to those companies that were well-networked, but not necessarily technologically most astute, both in terms of materials like bio leathers that had, you know, regular polymers inside when you really double clicked on it, et cetera, but also circular systems. I'm not going to throw any particular company under the bus today. And I think that is something that, you know, we also explored, but then we realized other markets are just more structured. They operate on longer than seasonal cycles. So you have more planability. Executives stay longer in their roles. So they're there to reap the rewards and you know, they have a different incentive structure. So I would say looking at markets, fashion is very difficult because of short development cycles or commercial cycles, and automotive at the other end of the spectrum is difficult because of long development cycles, and every other consumer product and packaged goods / packaging solution in between is somewhere on that line. So we built our ICP, our ideal customer profile, based on how much commercial upside we can offer them at the lowest TTV, at the lowest time to value, rather than by industry, which sounds a little bit contrarian, but works really well for us. So we look at a company, we're like, how much are they missing out on their secondhand market? Like, if they owned their secondhand market, how much would that contribute to their bottom line? How much high quality revenue could they get? How much are they struggling with churn / diminishing lifetime value of their customer because there's less brand loyalty, and getting those customers that they already had back, how much consequently can that mean to them? And then adding those up creates a ICP pile or a pyramid where, like, let's go for those companies where we can add a lot of value very quickly, rather than thematically hammer a vertical.
And do you take those learnings from the various industries also to consult one or the other company or vertical? Because, I mean, a lot of things can be done if you go upstream into the manufacturing, where products come from, how they're built, how they're designed and all that. So to which extent do you have conversations with your clients there as well?
Yes. So it's super interesting. Like, obviously, there is a... You have a ratio of like, how focused are you, which there's benefit to just focusing on one thing, and how much cross-pollination benefits you. And right now, I'd say you need to have some discipline with focus, but there are certainly learnings from reverse logistics and in you know, certain e-commerce retailers are really excellent at reverse logistics, and certain fashion companies got pretty good at inventory management and liquidation. And they're like different learnings that you can apply to other industries. There's also a hedging effect where you have less concentration risk working with different industries, which introduces an iota of sanity in my otherwise insane startup existence. And so I'd say right now I'm happy that we're going for multiple verticals at once. It's obviously something that we considered and we're not naive about, but it also requires us to decisively pull the plug or pull the trigger on verticals as we assess and reassess them.
Okay, cool. I mean, that all sounds pretty good, but like the difficulty most of the time is within the company itself. So you have all these silos, and one are quite intrigued by innovation, driving the company forward. One pretty stubborn, traditional, some call it. And how do you make it that they collaborate for the right thing, yeah, for circularity, to move this company to the next level? What is your secret about that? A secret ingredient, maybe, yeah? Get them all on board, yeah.
Secret ingredient? There's no blanket rule, but the closest thing to a generalizable rule is work with the Americans. So even when we work with European conglomerates or companies, we work with the American business unit first. I think that's the only thing that's highly transferable. The other thing is,
why the Americans in that sense?
There is a upside maximization versus downside hedging mindset. So okay. Oftentimes, and you know, we all know the DACH region. In Europe, we're optimizing for not making mistakes. I forgot who said it, but all new fails. When you do something new, something about it is going to be deeply wrong. And as long as it's not catastrophic, like we've never leaked customer data or payment data, our payment rails are very safe, our know your transaction compliance is very safe. But like, you know, something about the UI UX might not be perfect right off the bat, or people might be confused whether they're doing a return or trading back. So far that hasn't happened, but like I'm just trying to come up with examples. If you're willing to like take the hiccups because you're so interested in the upside, like the loyalty that you can drive and the metrics that you can drive, that makes sense. If you're trying to do something where you're never going to make a mistake, it's going to be very hard. And I think in Germany, we're at that point where we love talking the American way, but we don't do it. And if that is reflected in the whole startup ecosystem, we're rarely the ones to do something first. We're just very close. We just tend to copy American startups that are at Series B or C and growing quickly and then consolidate into them or like have multiple such startups in Germany. So like I find it more difficult to do the first pilot, the first proof of concept in Europe than in the US. I'm oversimplifying. There are exceptions, but I would say like that's strong. It's a pretty good rule to follow.
Okay. And what is the next big shift or next big thing that is coming up to drive circularity in the companies?
Our Lord and Savior Donald Trump. Of course. I hope this gets quoted out of context. So deglobalization, whether it's being pursued for the right or wrong reasons, is not something I'm gonna comment on now. But the nearshoring and reshoring of supply chains. The wanting to make yourself independent from materials that you cannot mine or source in your own geography or friendly geographies. Those kind of things are quite important. So a sovereign supply chain is usually a pretty circular supply chain and ecosystem that you run in your country. If you don't want to be dependent on conflict minerals or rare earth minerals, whatever you want to call them, re-extracting them from end-of-life consumer electronics and having them locally available for injection into near-short and on-short supply chains is a good idea. If you want to have tariff-free consumer products where you can appreciate really high gross margins, in fact, the highest gross margins, that's your second-hand market. It has higher gross margins, plus it's tariff-free because you can just buy back from the end consumer and resell to other end consumers in your own geography. It's easier to set up repair supply chains in your own geography than replicate the complete global supply chain. So if you want to have your own product being resold domestically, making sure you can repair the product in circulation is a much easier, lower, quicker infrastructure lift than building your whole, duplicating your whole entire global supply chain and copy-pasting that into a protectionist geography. So I think the biggest singular driver, bigger than environmentalism, is deglobalization, which is quite interesting and for some of us, bittersweet.
So that means also that it would be ideal to have tax-free products with raw material or rare materials coming into Europe and then do the recycling and repairing all here and keep the material in the Yeah, in the continent mainly. So
get
the cell phones in here, no tax, yeah, or get the e-cars here for a certain time. As soon as we have enough of this material floating around.
If you look at the supply chain laws coming into effect, as long as we tax as long as we penalize the export of those materials at the end of life, I think your suggestion makes sense. If you like, say, carrot for anything that contains a meaningful amount of hard to source and critically important materials in, but then stick for trying to get rid of those things at the end of life and ship them to sub-Saharan Africa to pile up and be burnt in open fires. Think Katamanto market, etc. And then there's the gray zone of like the secondhand market for consumer electronics is booming mostly south of EU. And how much like resale outside the EU do you allow? And right now they're enjoying tax benefits, those companies, and maybe environmentally that's right now a good thing. So there's a trade-off there. But yeah, I think broadly speaking, make it cheap to get the good stuff in, and make it expensive to get rid of it, and create the incentive to locally maximally valorize it, be it through secondhand, but also disassembly and recycling.
Yeah, could be fun to discuss export tariffs. Yeah.
Well, there are some exporting clothing waste and consumer electronic waste via both directives and initiatives from the EU is like percolating into member state law. You saw France actually in France, you saw the first fines to consumer brands who do not comply. Mm-hmm. So some of this is already happening, just at the back end, not at the import. Like you're talking about like a reverse CBAM.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting idea. And at the very least, it's controversial and generates debate. So
well, it's a good topic for discussion on a panel or something like that. Something different. Like, if you talk to supply chain leaders, usually what do you tell them, what they should look out to concerning circularity over the next years? What should they do? Yeah, because currently, I believe a lot of them are overwhelmed with everything what's happening, lacking focus. But what do you tell them in your projects usually?
Yeah, it's really, really difficult. And there's no one-size-fits-all solution. So it's probably impossible to get the timing right, perfectly right, on when to offer local manufacturing in which geography. But I think there is an opportunity for reverse technology transfer from the Far East to Europe in terms of tool making, mold making, etc., etc., and probably leaning into that for the manufacturers in the Far East is a good thing. Companies like TSMC considering fabs or like doing fabs in the US, etc., are leading the way. It's just like you just need to make sure that your stakeholders accept that you can get this directionally right, but be wrong on the timeline and have your infrastructure piece or your investment or your acquisition happen 1 or 2 or 3 years too early. And you need to build a consensus around, hey, we're doing this, so we're not on the wrong side of history 5 years from now, but like within that 5-year timeline, we'll do some things too early and some things too late. Please incentivize, you know, the long-term outcome. And depending on your ownership structure, that's going to look very different. If you're private equity owned, you got to get things pretty right because the hold period is so short. Like, you know, at the end of a 2 to 5 year max hold period, you got to be in a superior financial position because you're essentially a P&L widget. I'm exaggerating, but like, so in that case, introducing things like Pentatonic, where you get immediate access to the secondhand market, is probably more salient than building infrastructure pieces to have local supply chains that may not, you know, come online or be cost competitive just yet. But if you're, you know, family-owned business, you have the opportunity to say, like, I'm gonna just put in motion what I know is definitely gonna be the case by the time my children or grandchildren's generation are in charge. And if I get it wrong, even by 5 years, it doesn't fundamentally matter. The like total area under the curve of efficiency that I drive between now and my children taking over is what I care about. And it doesn't matter if I have a little dip here, if I'm going to get a lot more at the tail end. So I think that's important. A very positive thing is that executives that are being appointed now have the certainty that they will probably still be in charge when they have to cash the check on the decisions that they now make. So I think we're seeing more decisive movement with recently appointed C-suite members.
That's pretty interesting, yeah. Johan, thanks a lot. It was a great discussion. And we're looking forward to your press release and all the things you do with your company. And I'm really hoping that the whole thing is developing even stronger and stronger from year to year. And we have to do it for the sake of our children and for us anyhow and for the planet, that we move forward and go more to circularity. Also from a business point of view, because that's going to be the next big thing. And it will be very interesting. Thank you for being here at our show, Johan. And looking forward to talk to you soon again.
Do it for your children or do it for profit. We're on board.
Do it. Just do it.
Cool.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Perfect.
Have a good one.
Johan, thank you. Bye. Bye.